I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, how much sleep do you need? Can you train yourself to need less sleep? What about short spurts of sleep during the course of the day? How does caffeine affect our sleep cycle? What about digital devices in bed? And is it okay to take melatonin regularly? And what happened to the young lad many years ago who stayed awake for 11 days straight? Can you imagine that? 11 days straight. Joining us this hour is Dr. James Hamblin. He's senior editor at The Atlantic. He writes the health column in the monthly magazine and also hosts the popular video series, If Our Bodies Could Talk, which is also the title of his forthcoming book. We'll have to interview him when that book is released. He says in an article in The Atlantic, since his residency, he became sort of obsessive about sleep because during the residency, he worked hospital shifts that could last 36 hours without sleep, often without breaks of more than a few minutes. We'll be talking about what residency does to people and how that may have changed since the time he was a resident. But the whole, we spend so much of our lives sleeping or trying to sleep, it's a worthwhile thing to discuss, don't you think? We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're on Facebook as well, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we like to read your comments always. And we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Dr. Hamblin, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
How did you sleep last night?
I slept great.
Did you?
Thank you.
Yeah. Excellent.
It was a good night.
That's good. I can't imagine going through residency, and maybe the rules have changed, but when I can see how you become obsessed with the topic of sleep because you work these shifts that could last 36 hours, and you had to be sharp during those hours.
Yeah, you do. You're taking care of people in life or death situations. It wasn't unique to me. That's something that all residents go through. Depending on your specialty, some people have to do more of these really long shifts. And actually, amendments to that rule are under consideration right now by the accrediting body that trains residents. But it's always been a sticking point as to how do you do this in a way that's safe for patients and also is safe and healthy for doctors. As we know, it's simply there's no way to stay awake and alert for 30 hours and have it be safe for your body.
Right. And certainly for the people you're taking care of. You mentioned in the article that at one point you're discussing a very serious topic with a patient, advanced directive, and all of a sudden you had to look down at your chart and you started laughing, which is something that can happen if you're delirious.
Yeah, that was totally mortifying.
I
felt weird even sharing it in the article, but, you know, it is what happened. And it's that the basic idea in a lot of sleep deprivation research is that we're not good at recognizing how impaired we are. It takes some sort of extreme things have to happen for us to recognize that degree of impairment. So something like that, some sort of feeling of really not being in control or really, you know, forgetting something bad before you start to think, gosh, this is no good, because we tend to think I can power through. It's sort of a weakness of my willpower for me to say I need to take a break, and that's just a cultural approach to sleep that is dangerous for everyone.
Mm-hmm. You cite, and these are interesting studies, you cite many of them, a Finnish study that looked at the amount of sleep that we should get, and it correlates with the fewest sick days.
Right. So, it can be tough to find an ideal level of sleep. Different studies give you different numbers, and this was a novel one that just looked at, assumed that the healthiest people must be the ones who take the fewest sick days from work, and those were numbers were 7.6 for women and 7.7 for men. I believe that was it. And so the point in that was just saying that, you know, when you look at correlations like that, you don't know if maybe those were just the people who happened to be sleeping for another reason, or they were the best at lying about needing to skip work for a certain reason. And but when you take all these studies together in aggregate that look at health effects and sleep, it seems that for most people, 8 hours, 7.5 to 8 hours is optimal. Below 7 hours, you start to see impairments in different levels of executive functioning, and then below six is where you're talking about increased risks of chronic illness.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this concept of sleeping in short bursts. You say that it has spread since sailing races in the 1960s, when people had to stay awake to check on the seas and the winds and make sure they stayed afloat. I also remember that reading somewhere that Teddy Kennedy used to sleep just 10-minute power naps during the course of the day. He'd stay up really late, but the power naps seemed to help. I can't imagine getting by with 10-minute power naps or sleeping in short bursts. Can we train ourselves to do that? Does it hurt our body to do that?
There are definitely people who have trained themselves to do it. The consensus of the experts I spoke to was that you can't train yourself to need less sleep overall, but you can train yourself to either be biphasic or polyphasic. Most of us are monophasic. We just sleep in one big block at night. But you could, if you wanted to, say, partition that out into 90-minute blocks, and if you got enough of them, you could kind of continue to function throughout the 24-hour cycle while just taking those breaks.
Mm.
Not enough people have done it for long enough to be studied in a way that we'd have a lot of data to be able to say that was for sure safe or advantageous. So I can't recommend it and haven't spoken to anyone who would, but we know that there have been people who've been able to do it.
And what about those people? You talk about a very small number of people, short sleepers. They get maybe 4 or 5 hours a night and seem to be okay. Do we know why there are short sleepers, and how many are there?
That is fascinating. The difficulty in knowing for sure is that some people, you don't die immediately when you're getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. So you could have people who are getting by in the world just fine on 4 or 5 hours a night, but really are far from maximizing their potential. And so it becomes hard to say whether they're really a short sleeper or what category they fall into. 1% is the number that's commonly thrown around, and even the experts wouldn't tell me that they could say that for sure, because it would just, again, the level of analysis that would be needed to understand that fully is beyond our grasp. And then why someone would be so uniquely programmed to need less, that much less sleep than it seems that almost every other person needs, we don't know. I mean, the evolutionary reasons that we sleep at all are not understood, because it seems like sleep would be something that it would be more advantageous evolutionarily if you didn't sleep.
Right.
While you're asleep is when you get attacked by a predator, and if you could stay up hunting all night long, then you should have had a competitive advantage, but no.
It's nice to take a break, though, isn't it?
Yeah, well, if I didn't have to sleep, it's not to say I would work 24 hours a
right.
day, but I can have more time to myself.
Yeah, it's almost become, and I wonder where this came from, a point of pride for people to say, oh, I only need 4 hours of sleep, I only need 5 hours of sleep a night, and if you are a person who likes to sleep more than eight, people say, really? That's not good.
Right. Yeah, and that's a huge part of the problem when we don't take it as the health risk that it is. It's putting you at increased risk for all kinds of cardiovascular disease, almost any chronic illness you can tie to people who are sleep deprived. It's just it degrades you in every way. You don't get the restorative processes that your body needs.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's no other form really of that degree of self-harm that we tend to just applaud in people to see it as a virtue. If you,
right.
if you were taking some sort of toxic substance or doing physical harm to yourself, and other people would say, why are you doing that?
You
should stop.
Yeah. The other studies you talk about are those people who have had maybe 6 or fewer hours, and then they're studied the next day, people in the military and other people, and they say, hey, I'm doing just fine the next day. I feel like I'm functioning perfectly well. But when they are tested, it shows their performance, particularly on cognitive tests, is not very good.
Yeah. And that is something that has been well tested, because you can have people and do short-term sleep deprivation studies where people stay in a lab and, you know, you're able to verify exactly how much sleep they got and see how they perform relative to people who slept well. And the best analogy I've heard, I think, is likening it to drinking alcohol, and to where a lot of people who end up with drunk driving infractions of the law, they often believe that they were fine, or they felt like maybe they were a little bit impaired, but not as impaired as they actually were. And so you hear a lot of sleep researchers draw a comparison there to drunkenness, where we just lose our ability to self-assess, a sense of self-awareness of that is something that's compromised by the sleep itself. You think we're fine.
You mentioned alcohol in your writings, too. We'll talk about caffeine in a moment, but suggest that having alcohol in the nighttime might impair your sleep. If you're going to have a drink, maybe 4 o'clock might be a better time?
Yeah, that's something that's we definitely know, that alcohol has long been used, you know, throughout history to help people go to sleep, to calm nerves. And what it does is it is effective in that it helps you fall asleep more quickly, but it throws off the REM cycles and the types of sleep that you're getting, so that it's not as restorative. And people who are intoxicated tend to wake up earlier, and they don't get as good of a night's sleep ultimately. So it's misleading, because it makes you, it does help you to fall asleep, but by morning time you're not as restored as if you hadn't had a drink
before. And what about caffeine? What does that do to your sleep cycles?
Well, you know, fortunately, the reason that caffeine is so potentially the reason it remains so popular is the half-life is such that you can drink it in the morning, and it should not throw off your sleep cycles by nighttime. For most people, we can fully metabolize it and sleep fine. But its job, it's a stimulant, essentially cutting the brake lines on the body's excitatory system, so that you're staying hyper-aware, hyper-aroused, and it's doing everything that is the opposite of what happens in your body when it's going to sleep. I think there's a level of different people metabolize caffeine very differently, and it takes some self-experimentation to understand how late in the day you can really tolerate that. And there are some people who have, you know, coffee after dinner, and you don't feel particularly aware, and they feel like they're sleeping fine, but it actually could be one of these things that's subtly causing you to not get as restorative of sleep as if you didn't have it.
And the benefits of coffee, kind of mixed here, you say that it has not been proved to correlate with health or longevity, the antioxidants in coffee, but in a world where most people eat more than is ideal, caffeine, even at low levels, can suppress appetite, which may not be a bad thing completely, huh?
Yeah, I'd say it has been shown to correlate with health and longevity in a lot of studies. And you hear this commonly on sort of the nightly news, where they'll say coffee may be good for you.
Yes, they do a lot of coffee stories.
Yeah. And then it turns out, you know, it's a study of 100,000 people who live to age 90, and 90% of them drank coffee every day. So you have a lot of these really interesting correlations. And the coffee drinkers tend, in many of these studies, to live longer, to have fewer chronic health issues. But it's always hard in these studies to isolate that out. You know, if you are a person who drinks coffee, what else comes along with that behavior? Does that mean you spend more time going out with friends? Does it mean that the coffee gave you the energy to exercise more? Mm-hmm. What other, you know, how else did it change your diet? Did it suppress your appetite, even just slightly, even just to the point that you're taking in the 30, 50 fewer calories every day, you know, something we might barely notice, but is an effect. I hesitate to say in itself, and we don't have a plausible mechanism for why coffee would promote health other than the antioxidants, which a lot of people point to, But when you take antioxidants in isolation, they don't seem to have the same effect. So there's something about the holistic idea of a life that involves coffee that seems to be good for health.
Mm. We'll talk about melatonin. We'll talk about bedtime and what about getting up and should you vary it? Can you make up? I wonder about this because I've heard that in some sports seminars, people have been told that you can make up your sleep if you miss a lot of it during the course of the week. Can you make it up by doing 12 hours on Saturday and 12 hours on Sunday? I wonder, can you? And we'll talk about other things that you can do. Screen time, what about screen time, watching TV as you get close to bed? Is that okay? Is it not okay? How to get a better night's sleep is ahead of us with Dr. James Hamlin. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, writes the health column in the magazine and also the video series. He's host of it, If Our Bodies Could Talk. And he's going to have a book on that very topic coming out soon. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. A couple lines are open for you right now. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network. All right, to phone calls as we talk about sleep this hour, and David in South Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Hi. I love it when you do these health programs. You do such a good job at interviewing them, Kathleen.
Thank you.
I'm calling in regards to Alzheimer's and sleep. I understand that during the night when you're sleeping, the brain goes through a detoxification. It kind of rinses itself out, including the beta amyloids. Does that happen earlier in sleep, or does it happen throughout the sleep cycle? And also with polyphasic sleep, I'm wondering if one sleeps, I believe it was Tim Ferriss in his 4-Hour Body book, I can't recall which one, says that one can make up for 1.5 hours of sleep, less sleep by a 20-minute nap. And just multiply it by the number of times that you have a sleep cycle reduced by 90 minutes, taking a 20-minute nap at regular times. Would that affect the Alzheimer clearing, the Alzheimer plaque clearing basis for the brain?
Good questions, David.
Yeah, great questions. And to the polyphasic sleeping, it's something that is just not widely studied. I mean, the very idea of sleep being a time to clear out the buildup of plaques that eventually cause Alzheimer's. It's a very compelling idea right now that has some evidence to support it, but it's still early on in understanding that, and so applying it to these rare approaches to sleep, like polyphasic sleeping, we don't know yet. So it would be totally, speculating to comment on that, but and the same with as far as when in the sleep cycle the Alzheimer's plaques would be being cleared out. This is a study that came out just within the last year for us that's proposing this idea. So when and how and how ideally to sleep to optimize that process still remain to be understood, but it was a wonderful finding to know that could be something that arming ourselves with better sleep could be a useful tool in the fight against Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm. And what about these 20-minute naps?
Yeah, everyone that I've spoken to is actually an expert, and I know Tim Ferriss has done a lot of his own self-experimentation, has told me that you just can't, there's no shortcut. That while you are able to go polyphasic or biphasic and train yourself to do things in bursts and you know, to sleep less at night and make up for it with naps during the day, you can't decrease the amount of sleep within any given 24-hour period that you need.
Mm.
If you're a 7-hour person, you got to get the 7 hours some way.
Mm-hmm.
So no shortcuts.
So what about trying to make up for it on the weekend? Is that beneficial or not?
Yeah, it can be bad. There is also benefit. This is the kind of frequent paradoxes. There's a benefit to getting up and going to sleep at the same time. So the question that people disagree on is, say you've already stayed out until 1 o'clock in the morning, is it better to still go ahead and get up at 6:30 in the morning or 7 in the morning as you normally would, or to sleep in? And There's certainly no consensus on how far into the night you'd have to be going to sleep, but there's benefit to rising at the same time, and that keeps your body on the same rhythms and prepares you for sleep the following night, and could actually be better than sleeping in too far. So it's a constant trade-off.
Mm. So what about going to bed earlier that next day when you've missed some hours? That doesn't seem like a good idea either?
That's something that's less supported. So it's you hear a lot about known benefits of getting awake at the same time. But if you are truly exhausted, going to bed early seems to be better than keeping yourself awake. Not too early. You wouldn't go to bed at 3 in the afternoon, but
right.
Go to bed at a reasonable hour and make up for an hour or two. Again, you know, there's give and take here, and how far you vary from the ideal of simply going to sleep at exactly the same time and waking up at exactly the same time every night. You know, it's the real world, and so everybody's got to vary from that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, David, for your call. Mike in West Dallas, hello.
Hi. My question for the guest was, it's based off of working on third shift. I work in a law enforcement-related field, and the old axiom in law enforcement was you can make up for 8 hours of uninterrupted sleep by breaking it up into two blocks of four or maybe a block of two and a block of six. I was just wondering the guest's opinion on is there problems with that, or is that a viable option for staying healthy and keeping a good sleep cycle?
Is that what you've done, Mike? Do you break it up?
Yeah, that's usually what I try to do based on all the people who had preceded me said, you know, the best way to balance life and sleep and work is that because you can't just sleep for 8 hours during the day if you're working third shift, it would be better to maybe go to bed right after you get off of work, wake up, do some time with the family, and then get a longer sleep before your shift actually starts. And obviously, like a doctor, law enforcement, you're making decisions that you need to be acutely aware of, and you have to be alert. You can't be sleepy or exhausted.
Right. Third shift is rough, isn't it, doctor?
There's also a debate as to whether it's better to stay on nights. I know some police departments give people the option of staying on night coverage indefinitely versus swinging back and forth because, kind of like we were talking about in the previous answer, there's value to consistency as well as value to net amount of sleep. So, those things are often at odds. Should I try to get to bed at the same time, stick closer to a nocturnal or diurnal schedule, or should I just try to get 8 hours however it works? And we know that if you get the same amount of sleep within a 24-hour period, that you should be able to alter the way in which you do that, whether it's biphasic, polyphasic, in a block of six and a block of two, but that it's also very hard for someone to adapt immediately, you know, do something different every day or even every week, that it takes time for your body to get used to those cycles so that when you lie down, you fall asleep and you're within REM, not long thereafter, and otherwise you'll be lying there in this sort of non-restorative sleep, and even though you technically slept for 8 hours, it's actually not as good as sleeping as another form of 8 hours of sleep would be.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, it's sort of a complex answer, but it's basically that it takes time for you to adapt, and the more you can consistent you can be, the better.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mike. Ron, Crandon, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is really interesting. I'm wondering, you know, back 30 years ago in kind of a basic human phys class in college, we learned about this, and it seemed like there was a pretty good understanding of these cycles and how harmful they can be. And it seems strange to me, and I wonder why the one profession, the medical profession, which you think would understand this the best, seems to be the one that kind of abuses this the most. So many opportunities for life and death decisions that they need to make, yet they seem to be the ones that are so proud of their 30 straight hours and so forth.
Yes.
I'll take comment off the air.
It is hard to understand. That's a good question.
I know. I found myself asking it constantly. And why there are so often McDonald's in the hospital cafeterias and the food or just generally unhealthy hospital food being served to patients. It's not an atmosphere of health in a lot of ways. And there are logistical reasons. When you come into the emergency room, if a doctor meets you and hears your story, then you're taken upstairs. You kind of expect to see the same doctor for a while and for them to follow you through your treatments and care. And if people are changing shifts constantly, that can be disruptive to the patient to have to be meeting a new doctor every 8 or 10 hours. And there's also errors that are introduced every time doctors change shifts. We know that when they track hospital errors, that's usually when it happens, is when someone leaves, someone new comes on, and they don't know all the new patients in the hospital. So the fewer times you can change shifts, you do decrease errors in that way. So again, you're balancing the tension of having exhausted doctors versus having a lot of shift changes.
Mm-hmm.
It's something they're constantly trying to hit the safest mix on.
Todd sends this email. I can't seem to sleep for more than 6 hours, regardless of what time I go to bed. I usually wake up after 6 hours of sleep and can very rarely get back to sleep. However, I function pretty well, and I'm very rarely tired at all during the day. Is this normal?
It can be, yeah. You might be one of the lucky ones, is what I would say. Yeah. There are people who don't need the 8 hours, and there isn't cause to freak out about that if you're not one of them. In fact, I would enjoy it.
Jim in Fort Atkinson. Hello, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have the opposite problem of other people now. I've been retired for 10 years. And I've developed a sleep habit of 10 hours, regular.
Mm-hmm.
And today I got up after about 8 hours, I had to go someplace. And I had to really push myself to get out of bed.
Mm.
And the question it's like I can just roll over and I'll go back to sleep and I'm real comfortable doing it. I would rather get back to about an 8 and a half hour perhaps, or something like that. What kind of advice might there be for this situation?
Yeah, that's something that's worth talking to your doctor about, because sometimes there are reasons that you may not be getting as restorative of sleep, and they could go through everything in your life that could be affecting that. And if you aren't getting as restorative sleep during the night, you can end up, feeling like you need to sleep in or feeling like you need 10 hours just because you didn't get those 8 hours of quality sleep.
Well, and some people, you go from, 7 to 9 hours of sleep. Some people need that, right?
Yeah, although the normal arc of human life is to sleep less as we age.
Oh, that's interesting. So
that's,
what do you need?
Typically.
So do you have a guideline of how much you need when you're in your 50s or 60s?
I didn't break down the guidelines by age, no, but it's just people tend to get less quality sleep and to wake earlier in old age.
Hmm. Why is that not true for animals? You look at your dogs, and the older they get, the more they sleep during a day, don't they?
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't get into the dog sleep studies. That's the next book, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Let's go. Thanks, Jim, for your call. Sarah in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. Yes, I have the same problem. I get way too much sleep for years. I'm menopausal. I'm being treated by a doctor because I have a thyroid problem, and I have lights in my house that mimic the sunlight to try to keep me awake. But I tend to sleep 2 hours, wake up tired, go back to sleep. I only have a wakeful time, probably 8 hours a day or so. The rest I'm in bed. I just can't. I'm just so tired. And the doctors, they just don't know what else to do for me. I'm just so tired all the time.
I'm sorry to hear it. I'd be speaking out of turn to try to supersede anything that your doctors have said or recommended. I know the, as much as I can try to break down the science of what we know about sleep, for a general interest audience, as I do with the magazine and in the book, I know everyone's everyone's story is unique, and everyone's life has and physiology has their own stories to tell. So that comes back to the benefit of having individual relationships with doctors and everyone understanding themselves and having doctors that can help them with this. So best of luck in continuing to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I can't be of help.
And having doctors who understand, and I'm wondering how widespread this is, Dr. Hamlin, how important sleep is. Doctors usually don't talk about how are you sleeping, do they?
Right. The list of things that doctors need to be asking about right now is in people's lives that affect their health is we understand how the food that we eat and the relationships that we have and the type of, you know, standing desks and all the whether caffeine, how much caffeine we should be drinking. There's just so much that it can be tough for a doctor to, you know, have the time to get into how you're sleeping and why you might not be sleeping well. And yet it's very, very important. This often falls to people to try to, until you have some diagnosable condition, to try to figure it on your own.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to help people sift through that information, but there's definitely a market for more sleep.
Dr. Hamlin, this is purely my own life, but I've heard from others as well. The days that I go for a swim or do a nice long walk, I really find that I can go to bed and fall asleep much more quickly than those days that I don't exercise. Have you studied exercise and how important it is to a good night's sleep?
You know, I have not seen that actually studied, but I know it to be true myself and in many people that I've spoken to. And I think it's more that the days that we exercise are more in keeping with our evolutionary history of how, you know, we're meant to be active people.
Yes.
And it's... The days when you spend the whole day sitting around, you're just throwing off your body's natural cycles wherein it should be tired, but it's not because it didn't burn any energy. So there's something to staying active, which is not novel
mm-hmm.
advice, but always true.
Sarah, thanks for your call. Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. I wanted to say that for many decades, I've been taking a drug called diphenhydramine HCL, which is sold over-the-counter. And the same product is sold either as a sleep producer or for people who have allergies. And I, as I said, have for many years taken this. I don't know what is actually happening in the brain that causes you to fall asleep after taking this, but I'm wondering, because people take it for an allergy, which helps their sinuses dry up. I'm wondering, does prolonged taking of this just to go to sleep actually causing maybe brain cells to dry up or ear passages or anything else in the body?
Yeah,
I don't
that's
really know what is
the,
what is actually happening in mm-hmm. the brain that causes sleepiness when taking this pill.
Yeah. You're testing my pharmacology memory from medical school, but diphenhydramine is Benadryl. That's the common trade name, and it's an antihistamine. And histamine is what causes when you have an allergic reaction, when you start to get sniffly or red, puffy. That's caused by a histamine reaction. So you can block that, and you can make allergies less severe. There's also histamine that is a neurotransmitter in the brain, and when you block it, you can make people drowsy. So that is one of the reasons that a lot of over-the-counter medications say they'll cause cold and flu medications
right.
cause drowsiness because they have this in there. But it's also been one of the most time-tested medications that we have for as a sleep aid. What I know about sleep aids is that very few doctors recommend that people are on them for years and years and years. But that again, every person's case is individual, and I have to defer to whatever you know your doctor's recommending to you. I don't know of any studies about it being a dangerous thing to be on for at least for short periods. I know it's commonly used to help people fall asleep.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Nancy, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We have yet to talk about melatonin. A lot of people take melatonin. There are also other kinds of sleep aids. We'll talk more about those and how long may be too long to be taking a pill like Ambien that has you fall asleep. A lot of people are on sleep medication. It's a big thing in this country. Screen time, we'll discuss that. What about computer time or even watching television? Should you cut off TV watching, being on your computer so many hours before you go to bed at night? We're welcoming calls for Dr. James Hamlin. He's senior editor at The Atlantic and writes the health column in their monthly magazine. He hosts the video series, If Our Bodies Could Talk, and that will be the title of his book that will be out pretty soon. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. The other area we want to talk about is, can you die if you don't get enough sleep? And what about this 17-year-old who stayed awake for 11 days? This is the Ideas Network. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Let's talk about light and nighttime and how using computers, iPads that tend to be fairly bright does something to part of the brain that's not very good if you want to fall asleep.
Yeah. This is something that we've just sort of been forced to figure out as we realize that a lot of people are having trouble falling asleep, and they're also staring for much of the day into the night directly into light-emitting screens, sometimes just inches from their face in the case of phones and tablets. And it turns out to make sense with a lot of physiology that we've known for a long time, that the body releases this hormone melatonin to help you sleep at night. And that is released in response to darkening ambient environments. So when it gets dark at night, your body releases this and tells you it's time to go to sleep. And if it doesn't get dark, if you're constantly beaming light into your eyes, then you don't get that release of melatonin, you don't feel as sleepy, and you either don't fall asleep as quickly or don't get as restorative of sleep. So the recommendation is to shut off phones. Some people say an hour, some people say 2 hours, to not look at screens in that time before bed.
What about melatonin?
Right. So then the alternative is to take a supplemental melatonin instead of your body's own melatonin. And it's been studied with various findings. Some people have found that it does help people fall asleep. But overall, from the experts I've spoken to, it's not, again, meant to be a long-term solution and isn't proven in the long term to give people overall more restorative sleep. It can help some people to fall asleep, and some people when they're converting from, say, night shift to day shift, be a useful tool in making that transition.
Sarah in Managua, hi.
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 I have a small child, and he's never slept well through the night, and I'm just wondering, like, as my sleep pattern kind of adjusts to his and I wake up when he does that affect, my sleep over time?
That's a great question. It can. It depends, you know, when you're waking up, but we do tend to adapt to, if you get used to waking up when he wakes up at an early hour, then that might be your new reset point until you have the opportunity to go someplace where you can sleep in until 9 a.m. every day.
How old is he, Sarah?
He's two.
He's two. So you've been through the really hard time when he was up all the time. Those are hard years.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Awesome. Well, thanks.
Yeah, thank you. And what about for new moms and dads who are getting up every 2 hours or 3 hours? Those are such exhausting times. You feel all you want to do is sleep. You just want to sleep. And it goes on for a long period of time. Has anybody studied that you're aware of, Doctor?
That would go along with, the health effects of having a child. I don't know, but I do know that from the people I speak to, that's a similar sort of moment in your life where you, similar to residency, where you
right.
you're so sleep deprived that you really do appreciate how necessary sleep is, and it starts to become a priority for you. Once you have the luxury of making it a priority again, once the child has grown a little.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah, for your call. Ray in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yeah, I'm a stagehand. I've been doing this for about 22 years now. And we work split shift, I guess, about three quarters of the year, especially during the summer festival season, like Summerfest and State Fair and places like that. And we do a very strenuous job often. And I rig, which is where I'm tying in ropes and cables and chains to somebody who's 60 to 90 feet above me. And they're depending on me doing every little thing exactly properly. Otherwise, they might get pulled off the beam, they might fall. And also, the things were hanging above the audience and above the performers might fall during a performance. So I call that highly stressful days when I'm ground rigging.
Mm-hmm.
On those days, I find it almost impossible to sleep during the day. And that's when I get the bulk of my sleep during these times. But if I'm truck loading, which is just me and three other guys in a truck unstacking cases, it's very strenuous too, but it's not, the danger is mostly to myself and my three coworkers instead of maybe 100 people being hurt by a speaker stack falling at a show. And I found what helped me after years and years of doing this is on the days when I'm ground rigging, I will force myself to lay down anyway and make sure I have my eyes closed. I might not be sleeping, but I do find it helps. And then when I go back in for the mode out is what we call that at night, and it's usually between 10 and 11 o'clock when that starts, I will have breakfast again for the second time during the day. And I found that that helps me kind of gear up and, like, wake up to go back in for the evening call. And I also heard that us split shift workers have higher rates of cancer because basically the cortisol or something is flowing through your body the whole day because you know you have to go back and maybe load 10 semis, you know, 3 to 10 semis in the evening, or maybe you have to go back and you're working with people 80 feet above you and everything's got to be just right. So eating breakfast before going back in for that second shift, I found helped me too.
Yeah. That's something we haven't really touched on, is the psychological drivers of good sleep and of poor sleep, and the vicious cycle that can create when if you just had a high stress day, it can be really hard to unwind, especially mm-hmm. if the work is requiring that you there were times, especially I know as doctors, that you have to be back at the hospital in 10 hours and you just got done with your shift, and if you're any kind of good doctor, you're still thinking about all these cases and you know, what's happening with the people at the hospital, and is there anything that you forgot to check back up on? And so it's almost as if built into that calculus, there should be time for decompression and notably not doing so by staring at a screen. So something like a ritual, like taking time for a breakfast or whatever meal, or just having old-fashioned phone conversations or reading books on paper. I think there's something to that for many different reasons, and rituals is an important one of them.
Mm-hmm. And what he does, just stretching out and closing your eyes for a while, too, that can calm you a bit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Ray. He also takes his job seriously and is concerned about safety, which is a good thing, but you don't want it to come at your own expense. Justin in Minnesota, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I'm a truck driver, and I drive in the middle of the night. I'm a slave to my job, and sleep comes second. I'm kind of wondering if possibly over a period of time, human beings in general are going to need less sleep as kind of an evolutionary adaptation, based on we're all slaves to our job. Some of us can work during the day, 9 to 5, which is nice, but then there's a lot of us that work in the middle of the night, ambulance drivers, truck drivers, police, fire, you know, doctors. You know, are we going to see possibly an evolutionary change in the next 50, 100 years possibly?
That's interesting.
Yeah. You know, I think that if we haven't seen it yet, we're not going to, because most of us live in, warm, relatively quiet houses, and if we didn't evolve to need less sleep when we were sleeping in the wild in much less safe conditions where we could have gotten taken out by a predator if we were sleeping, then we're probably not going to evolve to need less sleep anytime soon. That's the big mystery of the evolutionary origins of sleep and why we and all animals with brains need it. Not one species has figured out or evolved not to need it.
Mm. But some species, I think you mentioned the dolphins, that they kind of sleep with one eye on what's going around them. So they're kind of asleep and kind of awake at the same time, aren't they?
That is something that's often said. And I think there's the parts of it that there's some truth to it, that there's more alertness than we have, where we have no sense of what's going on around us. But everyone needs it in some form.
Yeah. You know? When you think about it, when you just said that, when you think about what we do, we just tune out. We just don't know what's going on for 8 hours a day. It's really something, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's just strange.
Yeah, it's kind of mind blowing if you stop and think about it, and yet every single person does it,
right?
And you die if you don't do it.
Yeah, and tell us about that young 17-year-old who stayed awake for 11 days. That's amazing. Anybody could do that.
Yeah, that was amazing. That was back in the '60s. A guy named Randy Gardner in California figured out he could do this. So he told some researchers at Stanford nearby, and they actually monitored him, and people verified that he never went to sleep for 11 straight days, researchers watching him in shifts. And he had some deficits, but was generally conversational. He beat the lead researcher in pinball on one of the later days. And he became sort of a mini celebrity thereafter. You can watch him online in some interviews, and he was well known at the time. And periodically there are people who come and try to break that record and do get close. So why there's anyone who can stay awake for 10 or 11 days and not, die or suffer acute health consequences, we don't know.
Let's go to Steve in Waterford, about a minute left. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was wondering, I'm 68 years old, and I've had sleep apnea for probably 20 years that I've been using a CPAP machine. And my question is there any negatives about using that for the rest of your life?
Not to my knowledge. A CPAP machine is a forced air pressure machine that helps. Sometimes people have anatomical obstruction to airway passage at night. It's one of the things that's associated with snoring loudly, and this sort of helps air in and out. And I'm not aware of any problems with using it chronically, other than it can be uncomfortable to wear, but it's increasingly common for people to use the machines.
Yeah, you just wish they would come up with something that was easier to wear, that was smaller.
Yeah, ideally.
Because a lot of people are using those, that's for sure. Thank you, Steve, very much for your call. Well, this was an interesting hour. Dr. James, thank you so much. When's your book coming out?
Oh, thank you for having me. It's December 27th, so it's pre-orderable right now.
It's coming up now.
Yeah, real shortly. And it's about much more than sleep. It's an FAQ for all human bodies, every element of the human body.
Mm. Thank you. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Dr. James Hamlin, senior editor at The Atlantic. His book, just coming up, released in the next couple, in the week, next week and a half, If Our Bodies Could Talk. He's also the writer of the health column in The Atlantic, and hosts the video series If Our Bodies Could Talk. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, and thanks to Zeb Gozman. Today's his last day. We wish him so well. Zeb has been an intern with us for several months and has done great work and unfailingly polite and helpful. I know he's been answering your phone calls, so wish him well. And thanks very much for all of your calls this hour. Stay with us. News is coming up, and then we'll talk about facts, hour two.